From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2002 when NASA released dramatic images that showed a portion of Antarctica's Larsen B ice shelf collapsing and disappearing. Now the space agency says what's left of that massive feature will be gone before 2020. And that comes as a surprise even to the scientists who knew that the ice shelf could eventually break apart entirely. The shelf is 625 square miles, nearly a third of a mile thick. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory reported this week that the change, the melting, and the breaking apart has been relentless. And so this ice shelf that has existed for 10,000 years will be gone within 5 years. And this marks just another kind of a sign point in the impact of climate change. This hour, we'll talk about what's happening and what might be done to deal with it. Let me welcome my panel for the hour. It includes Susan Spencer, president and founder of Rockspot. Susan, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me on, Evan.
Eric Hittinger is an RIT professor of public policy with a focus on energy policy, climate policy, and can talk to us about a number of issues, including some very interesting things happening in classrooms. Eric, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Abigail McHugh Griff is here. Abby's with the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, Mothers Out Front, among other things, and we'll talk about what those organizations are doing now. Nice to see you, Abby.
Nice to see you too, Evan.
And also on the line with us is Enid Cardinal. Enid is the Senior Sustainability Advisor for the President of RIT. Enid, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start on the science side, and we're not going to talk ice shelves for an hour, but I think this is a reminder to us about what is happening currently. And I think when NASA tells you even they are surprised at the rapid decline of this ice shelf, it should get everyone's attention. So, Susan Spencer, you are a scientist, but not a paleoclimatologist.
That's correct.
In fact, one of the prominent local paleoclimatologists, Vas Petrenko from the University of Rochester, is currently in Greenland, so unavailable. But we'll talk to Vas soon, I am sure, on this program as we have in the past. Susan, on the scientific side of things, though, let's just talk a little bit about what's happening. When NASA says even they're surprised, and you are no longer surprised by much when it comes to climate change, were you surprised by this?
I think that we were surprised by the prediction of the ice shelf being gone by the end of this decade, by 2020. That was a fairly shocking date to be assigned.
Okay, and when we talk about ice, there is a difference between sea ice and land ice, and I think that's important to point out. And so let's just talk a little bit about what that means here. An ice shelf is sea ice, and a lot of people I've heard say, well, I thought land ice is all that really matters here. Who cares? It's already, if it's sea ice, it's already in the water, so it doesn't matter as much.
Well, the thing about the Antarctic ice sheet is that it's composed of both land ice and sea ice. And the sea ice serves as a barrier to the land ice moving into the ocean. And this sea ice is commonly called an ice shelf. So when these ice shelves melt and disintegrate, there's no longer anything preventing glaciers from accelerating into the ocean and melting. So essentially, when the sea ice goes, the land ice follows it.
It's kind of, the way I, when I was reading about that, the way it kind of struck me was, if I am on a cold day, if I'm wearing a coat and I remove my coat, I'm going to get colder a lot faster. And so the land ice is more vulnerable now with part of that sea ice, land ice, ice shelf mix gone. Good analogy?
The shelves are acting as a barrier for the glacial movement. So they are preventing warmer ocean currents from being able to reach the glaciers. And it's those warming ocean currents that are really doing this precipitous melting that is causing the rapid disintegration of the shelves and then the glaciers.
A big 2015 study in Science estimated that Antarctica's ice shelves have thinned up by about 18% over the last 20 years, mainly West Antarctica, but also around the bigger East Antarctic region. And just some numbers for you. After Larsen A and Larsen B, again, a couple of ice shelves collapsed, or at least started to collapse, the glaciers behind them began losing ice, according to this study, into the sea 300% faster than before. Overall, studies have found that the loss of ice shelves has contributed to a 59% increase in ice discharge from regions of West Antarctica, and that's all helping to push up global sea levels. Doesn't mean that overnight global sea levels are going up, but I guess it's all a contributing factor, Susan.
It is a contributing factor, and the thing to keep in mind here is that scientists were not predicting that it would be happening this quickly. It is happening this quickly, which means that the predictions about global sea level rise need to really be considered as happening in a much quicker time frame than we were previously anticipating.
Okay, we're going to get to some of your calls and questions, and I already see the phone ringing, but if you want to call the program with comments or questions about what's going on and also what is going on locally among the various organizations, universities, even in the classroom, what's going on locally to sort of address climate change on local and regional levels, you can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. So we've kind of gotten our head around the significance of this news, and let me just kind of go around the table and ask Eric, for example. Eric Hettinger is an RIT professor of public policy and focuses on climate and energy policy. Susan is kind of just reflecting what we're hearing from scientists reporting this news, that this is a surprise, even though we've already known this was happening. What did you make of it?
Yeah, well, I would say the important takeaway from this is that it's not really so much about the glaciers. This article's about the glaciers being accelerating towards the ocean and melting and bringing up the sea level rise. And I like glaciers just fine, but what we need to remember is who this affects are millions of people that live right near sea level, right? So this is going to bring up sea level all around the world. And while in countries like the U.S. we might be able to put up dams and defend against that, there are millions of people in Bangladesh and other low-lying countries that are at risk of being underwater and just being displaced from their homes, cities no longer existing, and things like that. So this article is about ice shelves and glaciers, but the effect is on people. And I think people are kind of at least as important as glaciers.
Well, certainly. And when people hear 6 inches, a foot of sea level rise possible, you know, sometimes that is abstract even still to us. Sometimes we will think of a port city, a water-based city, and we'll say, well, okay, I'm looking at the water. Okay, it's a few inches higher. Is it really? You know, I don't think people are fully understanding the possible impact there.
Yeah, well, some cities have very low margins for error. So a great example in the U.S. is Miami. Miami always has had problems with high tides overrunning certain parts of the cities. So if you bring up the water level, even only a foot, which, by the way, is relatively conservative for what you're going to see in the next 50 years or so, you know, that could overrun half a mile or a mile of the central city of Miami. And things are even worse in developing countries because they haven't had the same building codes. They don't have the same technology and capital to respond to the problem.
We're not going to solve climate policy in an hour, but over the course of this hour, we're going to be talking to Eric and some others just about what you do. Certainly, he's right in that more affluent countries might be able to build dams or mitigate a little more effectively than countries that have less wealth or even higher populations right on the water. But does that mean we should be moving more inland? And more, or we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go throughout the hour. It's a very difficult but important question. Abby McHugh Griffa is with the Rochester People's Climate Coalition and Mothers Out Front. Real briefly, first of all, Rochester People's Climate Coalition is what, Abby?
It's an organization of organizations locally that formed in the weeks leading up to the People's Climate March back in September of last year. Mm-hmm. At that time, I think it was 32 organizations joined together, businesses, political groups of various kinds, certainly environmental groups, faith groups. All these different groups came together to express support for action on climate and to help mobilize people to attend the march. And now, several months later, we've consolidated a bit and figured out how this organization actually is structured, how it runs, and new organizations are joining us all the time. So as of yesterday, we have 44 member organizations.
How would you describe your mission?
Oh, gosh. Well, our mission is simply to solve this climate problem. No big deal. but, you know, we have four goals, one of which is to encourage our leaders to take action on climate, both to mitigate and to adapt to climate change, also educating people about climate change. One, and thank you, Evan, for having us on your show today, is to encourage the media to bring attention, raise awareness to this issue, which is something that has not always been encouraging. And so that's mainly what we're focused on at this point.
Okay. Enid Cardinal is with RIT, the Senior Sustainability Advisor for the president of RIT. Enid, first of all, for our listeners, most of our listeners had no idea that this position even existed, nor did I until I think yesterday. And I think that that's fascinating and pretty interesting. What is your role at RIT?
Actually, one of my primary responsibilities here at RIT is the execution of our climate commitment. Dr. Dussler, several years ago, signed on to the American College and University President's Climate Commitment, which is a commitment to achieve carbon neutrality as soon as possible, the end date being 2050 or sooner, and we chose 2030. And so my responsibility is to figure out how to get us there, which is an interesting challenge. There's assumptions in there in, you know, the technologies that will come about. There's a lot of behavior changes that need to happen in order to make that happen. And we're making some progress, but we need to expedite that process to get us to 2030.
By 2030.
Other responsibilities, yes, by 2030, not 2020.
And so you've got 15 years to try to get to carbon neutrality. It is ambitious. And still in some ways the term carbon neutrality is kind of nebulous. So specifically, I mean, we think about transportation, energy outputs in various ways. But what are some concrete and tangible things that are on the list right now to start moving RIT in that direction?
Sure, you're correct. The transportation piece is hard. So on a college campus, or in any organization, when you're talking about greenhouse gases, you're looking at your Scope 1 emissions, which are generated on site. So it's typically fuel that's used in your vehicles and any fuel that's burned in the generation of electricity or energy on your campus. There's Scope 2, which is the energy that you're purchasing and directly tied to your operations. So, for example, we purchase most of our electricity. And then the Scope 3 is all that bigger nebulous stuff. It's tied to your purchasing footprint. It's tied to transportation for us commuting back and forth to campus. So that's a really hard one that's going to take a lot to try and tackle. But the Scope 1 and Scope 2 is a bit easier. So for us, Scope 1 is largely our natural gas, which we use to heat and cool our buildings. So our facilities department has been extremely aggressive over the last, for the last 20 years, really, in trying to identify opportunities for energy savings. So what we've seen on our campus is anyone that's come to visit RIT, you know, maybe 5 years ago and then today, will notice a dramatic growth in our square footage. But our carbon emissions and our energy consumption has actually gone down because of the efforts of our facilities program in trying to reduce our energy consumption.
Talking to Enid Cardinal, Senior Sustainability Advisor at RIT, a part of this panel as we talk about climate change today. If you're just joining us, the spark for this conversation was NASA's announcement earlier this week that the Larsen B ice shelf will collapse entirely by the end of this decade, essentially far sooner than scientists even expected. It is a 625-square-mile ice shelf in Antarctica, and it'll be gone, and when that happens, it tends to increase the melting on land ice, and that is what tends to really have an impact on sea level. If you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK. Let me grab Frank in Rochester, who's been waiting. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, I have a question for your guest. The city of Rochester is working on a climate action plan. I wonder if your guests have thoughts on what should be in the plan, and will it be comprehensive enough to matter?
It's a good question. Susan Spencer, you want to start? Susan's with Rockspot. Go ahead, Susan.
Thanks for the question, Frank. I think that the Climate Action Plan is going to serve as a powerful recipe for what we can accomplish here. I think that it requires extremely robust emissions reduction targets and renewable energy transition targets. I look forward to seeing both of those in the plan, and I have full faith in the Office of Energy and Sustainability to make that accomplishment.
And let me also add, Frank, I hope we answered your question first.
Someone, I'm wondering if it's going to be just officials who are going to be addressing climate change in our community. Are volunteers going to be asked? I mean, there's tremendous opportunities for environmental groups, but just volunteers to be able to help educate more of the public on this issue and getting the media to train more on this issue. I'm just thinking, will it just be wonky energy stuff, or is it going to be more of a widespread education of the public on what needs to be done? I've been reading the Portland, Oregon Climate Change Action Plan, and it is incredibly comprehensive. When they talk about transportation, they connect the dots between riding bicycles and how this will affect lowering greenhouse gases and how much is a very much a part of their plan. Here in Rochester, we're doing a lot on transportation. We're doing bicycle boulevards, but no one's connecting the dots. Even in the city's literature, you don't see anything mentioned on climate change, and they barely mention lowering greenhouse gases. We still are very uncomfortable connecting the dots. Will that change?
Frank, thanks for the call. A great point on Portland, by the way, and it's a good reminder for the host. We ought to have a conversation on this program and bring in the folks from Portland on the phone. But a couple of our guests were nodding. I want to start with Susan. He asked about volunteer opportunity, moving beyond just officials. So start there. How would you answer that part of his question?
Well, obviously, none of us here are able to speak for the city themselves, but I think it's critical to point out that there has been a shift in how municipalities, local and state governments are approaching this issue. There's a much stronger drive to bring in other types of thinking and other levels of participation above and beyond just the typical government structure. And we're seeing that both at the local and state level. So I am hopeful that this plan will operate in a similar way to the Portland plan by bringing in large swaths of the community that haven't yet been able to participate as actively as they may have wanted to.
Well, and Eric, that is an interesting and important point from Frank in that when we talk about whether it's transportation, we've talked about walkability, bike access, all of those things. They're sort of individual threads unless you decide to tie them together. And he's saying cities like Portland are doing that. He'd like to see, and that doesn't mean Rochester isn't or won't, but what do you make of his point that those are threads that could really be tied together?
I agree. They are threads that can and should be tied together. But one point that I'd make in the comparison to Portland, which is a tough comparison to make, is that Portland has been at this for decades. Portland has been planning out climate action plans for decades. And Rochester is a bit newer to this game. So I guess I wouldn't think about the Rochester Climate Action Plan as a completed product. The way I would think about it is as soon as the Climate Action Plan is passed, that's day one of negotiating and planning out the next climate action plan, that we need to make progress from wherever we are and keep pushing. And Portland has been doing that, and they've been doing that for much longer than we have, and they're a bit more advanced. Ideally, we would be able to catch up pretty quickly, but I think as long as we are always talking about it, as long as we're always pushing on this problem and trying to improve things, then we're frankly in a good place.
And Abby McHugh-Griffa, one of Frank's concerns is making sure all of us can feel involved if we want to. And so, again, with groups like Rochester People's Climate Coalition, among others, you know, that's you. You're a mom. You're a concerned citizen. You're not a city official or an elected leader. But do you feel that there are growing opportunities to get involved on sort of grassroots level?
There are absolutely growing opportunities. But I would just point out that politicians don't create political will, they respond to it. So, you know, if everyday citizens listening to this program right now are concerned about this issue, well, pick up the phone and call someone at the city and just say, I'm concerned about climate change. What are you doing about it? What's going on with this action plan and how can we strengthen it? I mean, that voice has to, as you said, come from below. It's that groundswell. And as awareness is being raised, that is happening more and more, I think, which is very encouraging.
Enid Cardinal on the line with us from RIT. First of all, you want to weigh in? Go ahead, Enid.
I do want to weigh in a little bit on this one. One of the things, I think I expect that the city will be very inclusive in their process. And again, I can't speak to them, but one of the challenges as a sustainability professional myself, I have people come to me all the time on our campus to say, this is a problem, what are you doing about it? Well, I can help coordinate, I can help facilitate, but ultimately it comes down to all of our individual actions. So the city is going to be very welcoming to people that want to come and help. I mean, we're divided into, and I'm a city resident, and, you know, the more we can get involved in our neighborhood associations to try and drive change and raise awareness within those neighborhood associations, the city is going to welcome those opportunities to be able to find those partners that can help them do the work.
Susan Spencer is here from Rockspot, and one thing that we haven't mentioned yet, at least in too much detail, is the question of I don't even like using the term alternative energy because sometimes people have kind of outdated views on what that is, or alternative is always changing. I think what we probably mean by that is non-fossil fuel energy. But anyway, the bottom line is so much of what Susan is doing is going to be covered on this program within, hopefully by the end of the month or next month. We're going to talk more about solar energy. One of the most common questions I've gotten from listeners since I started hosting the show a year and a half ago was the question of solar. So many different issues related to it. So for our listeners, that program is coming up soon when we're going to talk very narrowly about solar, and I know Susan will help with that. But solar is sort of a prong here, isn't it? And do you sense governments responding to that opportunity, to on the business side, on the homeowner side, et cetera?
Very much. I think that I'll start right here in Rochester. The city of Rochester is a very strong, active partner in the deployment of our very first Solarize the Flower City campaign, which is going to secure discounted installations for city residents. They have acted to support us in grant applications for increasing the overall amount of solar that is in our region. And the solar technology is a low carbon technology. So it does not generate or use a lot of carbon when compared to traditional technologies like fossil fuel. So when we think back to the originator of this program, which is the collapse of this ice sheet, you know, the collapse of the ice sheet is caused by warming oceans, and the warming oceans are caused by the increasing amount of carbon that's present in our atmosphere. So strategies like solar technology deployment make a ton of sense, both locally and nationally, and they are being very strongly supported by local and state governments.
Okay. If you want to call the program and weigh in here, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're talking to Susan Spencer, president and founder of Rockspot, which is online where, Susan?
Rockspot.org.
Rockspot.org, R-O-C, as in Rochester, rockspot.org. Abby McHugh Griffith, with the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, and Mothers Out Front, and other things. Mothers Out Front is what, by the way?
Mothers Out Front is what it sounds like, an organization of mothers coming together to demand action on climate change.
Okay. And local, or is it a local chapter of a national?
It is a organization that started in Massachusetts and expanded into New York State just in November of last year. We are the second state, and they are moving beyond that as well.
And where can our listeners jump online and find Rochester People's Climate Coalition, Mothers Out Front?
Mothersoutfront.org, Rochester People's Climate Coalition.org.
Eric Hittinger is a RIT professor of public policy, focusing on climate policy, energy policy, and Enid Cardinal's on the line with us, senior sustainability advisor for the president of RIT. Short break, and some of your questions coming in on Twitter and online. We'll get those questions in right after this break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're looking at development at the Port of Rochester. What are the plans and what are the complaints from some residents in the area and some who have been studying the project? We'll get you caught up to date on what the city would like to do, why they think it would spark life into that area, and why some residents are still fighting it. That conversation next hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Heart Hearing Centers, providing hearing care for adults and children for more than 40 years. Audiology services include hearing and tinnitus evaluations, rehabilitation, and devices to accommodate lifestyle needs. Details at harthearing.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, talking climate change with the news this week that NASA telling us that the Larsen B ice shelf in Antarctica, West Antarctica, is going to disappear a lot earlier than scientists thought. Before 2020, that ice shelf will be gone. It's 625 square miles, nearly a third of a mile thick. That event in and of itself is not the most significant climate change event ever, but it is a marker in a series of events that indicate to us that, there are certain dominoes that fall when the seas get warmer, when there's more carbon in the atmosphere. And so that has prompted us to discuss what is going on, even on a local level. If you get the sense that climate change is abstract, that you sort of feel powerless about it, we're trying to talk about, you know, this from a number of angles. What's happening on governmental levels? What's happening on college campuses? What's happening? What are moms and concerned citizens doing? And Eric Hittinger from RIT, I want to know how the issues are being taught. You're a professor on these various issues. Just looking down your syllabuses, I kind of want to take your classes. But you were telling us before the hour began that there is, in many ways, this is being given more weight in college classrooms than ever before. How?
It absolutely is. So at RIT, we just finished the spring semester, and we just finished teaching the first ever completely climate change-focused class at RIT. And it was a really experimental class that I put together with several other colleagues. There were actually four of us co-teaching a class And the four of us constituted an atmospheric chemist, a climate change modeler who works in the math department, a environmental scientist who studies the ecological impacts of climate change, and then myself talking about the economics of climate change and climate policy both at the national and international levels. And we taught this class across disciplines to try and impart these skills to a variety of students. In the future, what these students are going to need to know to really grapple with climate problems is an interdisciplinary perspective on the problem. That if you're just an atmospheric chemist and you throw up your hands as soon as someone starts talking about carbon taxes, you won't be nearly as effective as you would be if you can speak across disciplines.
How are the classes going?
Well, it just finished. We've gotten very good feedback from students. As I said, it was a bit of an experiment, four professors. We had a lot of guest speakers, covered a lot of topics. I think we put students out of their comfort zones. So we had some students that came from chemistry, very comfortable with chemistry and science, not nearly as comfortable with the ethics of intergenerational investment, for example. On the other hand, we had students from policy that loved to talk about Kyoto and international climate policy, but they were a little uncomfortable when we talked about the minutiae of catalyzing methane gas down into CO2.
So interesting. So you went from catalyzing methane gas to ethics. Climate change ethics. Ethics of multi-generational, what was the name of it?
I said intergenerational wealth transfer. So the idea with climate change, one of the issues is really if we're doing the right thing, we here in the early 21st century will be investing a lot of money, in a sense, spending a lot of money to deal with the climate change problem. And if we do that, the beneficiaries mostly will not be us. It'll be children and our grandchildren and great-grandchildren and actually the great-grandchildren of people across the world will be the strongest beneficiaries. So one of the biggest questions that philosophers and economists grapple with is how do you balance between costs to us and benefits to the distant future? You know, and what's the ethical thing to do? What's the right thing to do?
Well, Emily writes to the program and wants to know, do we need policies to limit allowable human annual consumption? Emily, that's broad. I don't know, but it's a good question, but I don't, human consumption comes in many forms, but she's asking about actual policy or maybe even law to maybe curb that or address that. Eric, you've got 2 minutes to solve that, that massive question.
Right.
But it's an interesting question.
Yeah, so I think what I like about that question is that it acknowledges one of the sources of the problems. It really is human consumption. One of the popular fictions that we all want to believe very strongly as Americans is that we can keep up with our current rates of consumption and somehow through technology greatly reduce our footprint, our impact. But realistically, technology will only get us part of the way there. And so reducing consumption is probably something that we'll have to do into the future. It's not a popular statement in America.
I want to get Abby and Ina before we get back to the phone. So just in a moment, we're going to come to you, Tom in Rochester. But Abby McHugh-Griffa, thoughts?
So I think it's important just to keep in mind what is politically viable at this time, because that's what we can get done, right? And so putting a restriction, a ban on what people can consume, that's probably not going to happen in the short term. But figuring out ways to incentivize people to reduce their consumption of fossil fuels is very doable. And for example, the carbon fee and dividend plan that Dr. James Hansen was advocating when he was here just a few years ago, or weeks ago rather, does exactly that. It encourages people to reduce their consumption of fossil fuels simply because it is in their financial best interest. It's not a moral decision. They're not thinking about future generations, although I might argue that they should. But no, it's just about if fossil fuels cost, if their cost reflects their true cost, the true cost of burning them in terms of health care, there's so many external costs that go along with that. If the cost of fossil fuels reflects that, people won't buy it because it'll just be too expensive. And renewables will then have a chance to take their place.
Enid, what do you think?
Well, again, I go back to we can we can't have policy solving everything as much as I would like to. My background is actually environmental policy as well. But in this instance, this is as much a human behavior change and potentially an education awareness opportunity as it is a need for incentive mechanisms such as a carbon price. An example, shameless plug for us right now, actually, I stepped away from our move-out collection program to hop on the phone. But this year, every year when students move out across college campuses, across the country, they discard a lot of usable goods, and they most of the time end up in the landfill. And each one of those has an embedded carbon footprint that is getting lost and sent to the landfill. And then the next cohort of students coming in the next year goes to the store and buys the exact same stuff. So this year, with a group of students, we are working to collect everything that's usable before it makes it to a dumpster. We're going to donate what we can and resell everything that's usable back to incoming students. So it's changing our social norms in trying to challenge people to think outside of the box on their behaviors, as much as policy is important as well.
What a great idea. What a really important idea, and one that I think we all can learn from. Really cool stuff. You're hearing, by the way, from Enid Cardinal from RIT, a senior sustainability advisor. Susan Spencer from Rockspots here. Abby McHugh Griffa from the Rochester People's Climate Coalition is here. And Eric Hittinger, an RIT professor of public policy, is here. Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay. I'd like to suggest super insulating all buildings that need heating and cooling down to 32 or lower. The other, not going into that too much right here, but the other one is all factories that have smokestacks. We should come up with a system of filter system on the ground instead of the smokestacks. And another one is I had a Honda Insight, and I was able to get 54.6 miles a gallon. The other thing is kind of far out, but why not have a used aircraft carrier parked right outside the melting ice and have it pump as much water as possible back over the melting ice, glacier.
Tom, thanks for the call. On the last one, I'm not sure. I don't know. Is that a possibility?
I think that there's a lot of space for innovation, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of space for innovative use of technology. I think one of the critical points that Tom made, and thank you so much for your call, Tom, is to paraphrase a little bit, the cheapest energy is the energy we don't use. So when Rockspot believes that combining energy efficiency efforts with renewable energy efforts is absolutely critical. So his discussion about insulation for homes and businesses, this is something that we agree definitely needs to happen. And there is very strong support for this at the state level through NYSERDA campaigns that are working to bring as much energy efficiency technology to as many people as possible with discounted or even free availability based on your income.
Eric?
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't heard anything about spraying water up onto the glaciers, but one of the interesting things that's similar that is being done in Europe, in some places they're actually putting white plastic sheets out on top of the glaciers to help reflect more of the light and keep the glaciers cool. It's kind of a Band-Aid to the much bigger problem, but it's an interesting idea.
Probably shouldn't count on that to save it, though.
Right.
Do more. Here is a rather blunt comment from a listener named Marco. Marco writes and says, "Sorry, but I grew up on the water, and I think we need to start now," and he puts "now" in all caps, "I think we need to start now in relocating homes and businesses inland." All right, Eric Hittinger, we as we talked earlier this hour, on the policy side of things, if you look at sea level, and every time sea level comes up, inevitably we get someone that calls or concern, and I understand why. They think, oh, well, that's just an apocalyptic prediction. We're not going to see a tsunami coming into Manhattan, et cetera, et cetera. First of all, on sea level rise, it happens, I think we're saying quickly because of historically it would be quick, but it probably wouldn't be overnight, right? There would be at least some sense of what's going on. But Marco's saying, don't wait. Go now, and you know, we can't stop it.
Well, unfortunately, we're committed to some amount of sea level rise. Even if we stopped emissions completely today, we'd still be committed to some sea level rise. I can say also, Marco, that I'm from Rhode Island myself, so I appreciate this problem. I know in Rhode Island that there is a problem that a lot of really expensive, fancy beach houses are having to be abandoned because the ocean is just getting too close and flooding it too frequently. Since I'm a policy guy, I always go back to policy points. One of the issues here is that there's federally subsidized insurance for houses close to the ocean, and there's still a big argument in Congress for obvious reasons about adjusting that. One of the very reasonable, in my opinion, policy proposals is to slowly phase out federal subsidies for insuring these houses, because insurance companies without federal subsidies are going to keep jacking up the rates slowly over time as these houses get more and more threatened.
Or cleaning up after hurricanes.
Or yes.
There is a difference. And this is not an anti-wealth comment. This is an observation that John Stossel and libertarians have been making for decades. There is a difference that if you are wealthy enough to purchase a large piece of property right on the ocean, you have to accept that there is some risk there, whether it's erosion over time, sea level rise, a hurricane. And then if you get buried, asking the taxpayers to bail you out is probably unfair. And that is not, again, that's not anti-capitalist, that's an anti-wealth. That's a comment that a lot of people make. Eric, you're suggesting that there may be more momentum for that, but is there?
It's tough in an era where some states don't let you use the phrase climate change, you know, and this is
talking about Florida, yep.
Yeah. they're not the only ones. There's not a lot of momentum for that because, as you kind of described, it's wealthy people that own these properties, and it's only a teensy drop in the bucket to the federal budget. But it would start to motivate what's called gradual retreat, which is to say we need to stop building things right on the ocean and start, you know, slowly letting properties near the ocean go and building new properties further back to acknowledge the realities of sea level rise.
All right, so 2 points there. Eric is saying that is one small policy piece that isn't going to solve everything in case sea levels rise in the way that they are unfortunately forecasted to, but maybe it sparks more change, gradual retreat, as you say. But what about the people who live near the coast and are not living in seven-figure estates and are feeling vulnerable?
Yeah, and there's also a lot of those in Rhode Island as well.
Yeah.
And in Florida, right? A couple feet of sea level rise in Florida puts the ocean miles in from where it was.
Sure, and in Asia and everywhere. Yeah, right.
Right. So we don't have good policies to deal with that. You know, people are going to be displaced from their homes, especially around the world, but also right here in the U.S., And we have not yet started to deal with those policies. To be honest, Congress is in a tough situation for passing anything that even acknowledges the existence of climate change. So coming to face these hard facts and coming up with a compromise of how to deal with these known repercussions that will happen in the coming 10, 20, 50, 100 years, that's probably not something the current Congress is about to grapple.
Susan Spencer?
I think it's critical to point out that the Department of Defense acknowledged climate change as a mission reality in 2009. So they have been actively working to understand how this was going to affect our troops since then. Because when you have this level of sea level rise, one of the biggest things that's going to happen are climate change refugees. And that's already started happening in Papua New Guinea, where entire islands have had to be evacuated because people can no longer live there due to sea level rise. When this begins happening in the most populous coasts all over the world, the United States is going to be called upon to respond, and the Department of Defense recognizes that. And they see this as President Obama stated today, this is a matter of national security. So it is definitely something that has to be understood and immediately acted upon by Congress.
Well, Tim wants to know if your guests practice what they preach. Do they drive cars and do they heat with gas? Abby, I'll start with you.
I drive a car and I heat with gas. I do have the most efficient, energy efficient versions of those that I could possibly afford. But it does weigh on my conscience. I recognize that even every time I go to a meeting with a group of activists to address climate change, for the most part, I get there in my car. And I wish there were more alternatives available. It's a problem.
Enid.
Unfortunately, my answer is about the same. I do offset my electricity for wind energy, but I do still have to heat with gas. I live in the city and don't have a geothermal alternative as of now. And up until I moved here to Rochester, I didn't own a car, and I biked everywhere I went. But when I got to Rochester, the transportation system was not accessible for me to be able to get back and forth to work in a time-efficient fashion, let's put it that way. It takes me less time to bike to work than it does for me to take the bus, which I do bike to work whenever the weather is conducive. But it is a challenge, unfortunately. Yeah. I even have told people up until I shoveled my driveway. I never bought a gas-powered snowblower or anything like that, and I called it my penance for having to drive a car, which people thought was extreme, but that's one of my little quirks.
Susan Spencer?
I think that a more appropriate question would be, are we able to make a switch if we want to? And the answer to that is no, because the fossil fuel industry, through government subsidies, is able to keep prices artificially low, which promotes the things like driving of cars over public transportation and the heating of your home with natural gas as opposed to switching to a renewable energy. So I don't know that the spotlight should be shined on the guests of this show or on any one person. I think that we need to be asking hard questions of the multinational corporations and governmental institutions that are prohibiting us from moving in the direction we need to as a species.
Well, let me pivot that to Eric, using that point that Susan just made in a couple of ways. Number one, for the callers who inevitably say, well, why do these changes and developments require government subsidy? If you think fossil fuels aren't subsidy, we can send you some white papers and some basic research or some basic headlines. There's subsidy everywhere, and fossil fuel is certainly heavily subsidized. So that is true. And Tim, I take Tim's point, but I haven't heard any guests on this program say everyone listening should not drive cars anymore, shouldn't do X, Y, and Z. I think what he's saying is practically, are you doing whatever you can? And Eric, I would ask you if you think it's a gotcha question, or is at least it a fair question to make us think, okay, day-to-day, what do we do?
Yeah, well, I think it's important. So we've mostly been talking about policy and pushes from the federal level or the state level mm-hmm. or the city level. But I think it's also important to make change from the ground up as well. We need both. Neither one of those is a sufficient response. And so, the transportation question is tough. Rochester isn't, as Enid pointed out, Rochester isn't the most bike-friendly city. It's moving in that direction, right? There are a lot of plans in that direction. But even, for me, when I have to travel across the country, in the U.S., I take a train whenever I can, but that is unbelievably difficult, more expensive, takes much longer. It's just a huge hassle to do that. And so you need some help from above to enable these sort of options. But to answer, was it Tom?
Tim.
Or Tim. To answer Tim's question. So I'm a pretty serious cyclist. So I do bike most of the year whenever I can. Although we do have, my family does have one car, and it's a Prius.
Okay. Chris writes to the program, wants to know what your panel thinks about nuclear energy, which is carbon free. That's according to Chris. Susan Spencer?
I got to say nuclear energy is carbon free. I think that it needs significant improvements in its overall efficiency. I think that already existing plants should be able to undergo efficiency and safety modifications. And I think that when we look at global implementation of nuclear, it has been done well in some places and not so well in others. So I'm not necessarily against it as long as it is done in the most efficient and safe way possible. This really is an all-hands-on-deck problem, and that's how I perceive it.
Okay. Eric, what do you think about nuclear?
So I'll get the ire of everyone here. So I generally, to me, the problem with climate change. The big thing that I want to grapple with is coal power. Coal power is the big problem. And I agree with Susan, it is a bit of an all-hands-on-deck issue. And so at least for the near term, until we can get renewable technologies where they need to be, which will honestly be decades from now, I'm generally in favor of continuing to use nuclear power. One of the points that I like to make is countries that have recently phased out their nuclear power, so Germany and Japan have been phasing out nuclear power, and in both cases, their carbon emissions have increased pretty significantly in response, that Japan is now using a lot of fossil fuels to replace their nuclear power, and Germany is burning more fossil fuels and importing high emissions coal power from their neighbors in Poland.
Yeah, coal is, having lived and worked in West Virginia and flown over coal slurry impoundments, that is, you haven't seen something from the air like a coal slurry impoundment until you've flown over it in a helicopter, as I did many times. It really is a remarkable thing to see, but it's an industry that has a hold on that state. And has a very, very powerful position. All right, let's start to wrap our conversation here as we've been talking about the sort of addressing climate change on multiple levels. And let me kick it over to Enid Cardinal, who's a senior sustainability advisor for the president of RIT. If you missed it earlier this hour, she is charged with figuring out climate change by 2030. Not exactly, but trying to get carbon neutrality to RIT by 2030. It's a very ambitious goal. And for you, Enid, as you seek solutions there, what are the barriers to solution? Is it changing the culture of human activity on a day-to-day basis? Is it convincing administration and budget setters that occasionally you need to make investments that may seem tough at first? What are the biggest hurdles to achieving carbon neutrality?
I think it's a little bit of all the above. We don't typically, if you look at a business and them trying to decide how they're going to be putting in investments around energy efficiency, they have a much shorter payback. As a university, we recognize we're going to own and operate our buildings. So making an investment decision where we realize we're going to see either energy efficiency savings or cost savings from avoided potentially demand charges that we see, you know, during the summer months, that's not that challenging for us. But they're trade-offs, because we have a limited budget that's coming in, and obviously with tuition costs being a concern across the country, we have to make very difficult choices. So we can't invest in absolutely everything today that we know would get us where we need to go, because we also need to operate our university, be financial stewards of our students' tuition dollars. So it's never a challenge in trying to make the case for the investment. We recognize we need to do it, and we do make monies available every year to invest in those technologies and efficiencies that we can to get us where we need to go in a cost-effective manner. But we just can't do everything all at once. And behavior change is a huge piece of it. We have 6,000 plus, maybe almost 7,000 students living on campus or in campus-run housing facilities, and so that's a big energy footprint. And the mentality tends to be, well, I paid for it, I'm going to get the most out of it that I can. So, you know, you leave the lights on, you leave everything plugged in, and those individual actions accumulate quickly. So driving behavior change, and we're working on, you know, running some education campaigns to try and change that, we'll see a significant drop if we're successful in changing behaviors on campus as well. And that's where our cost savings are really going to come in.
And Enid, just about a minute left. David writes in and wants to know, what is a formula for determining if you're carbon neutral?
We base it off of our greenhouse gas inventories. So every year we run a greenhouse gas inventory with all of the inputs that we know of, and that includes, you know, our transportation footprint. There's a little bit of loose numbers there, but and so it's looking at whether those are renewable energies, whether there's carbon sequestration happening through, you know, composting projects that we do or other carbon sinks. So it's basically an accounting sheet.
Enid Cardinal, Senior Sustainability Advisor for the President of RIT. Thank you so much for the time this hour, Enid.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Eric Hittinger is an RIT Professor of Public Policy. Fascinating to hear not only what's going on in the classroom, but just some of the interesting things that people are thinking about when it comes to climate change, what comes next, and policy as it relates to it. Let's continue the conversation, I hope, on future programs. Thanks for being here.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Abby McHugh Griffa, Rochester People's Climate Coalition, Mothers Out Front. One more time, if people want to find you online, for the average folks who just want to, I say average folks, there's no average folks, you know, we're all above average. Some of us are below average. But for people who want to get involved, where can they find you?
Well, we are all folks who need to get involved in solving this problem, and mothersoutfront.org is a good place to start, rochesterpeoplesclimatecoalition.org, and of course, Citizens Climate Lobby, don't forget them.
I knew there was a third. Rochester People's Climate Coalition.org. And Susan Spencer, rockspot.org. Look forward to a conversation with you very soon on solar, because I know there's a lot going on. We'll narrow our focus and jump in to try to answer all of the questions we've gotten on this program about how much solar costs, what's changing, how accessible is it, you know, how does it work, rural versus urban, all of that stuff. Come back and answer it soon.
I look forward to it, Evan. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening. Short break. We're talking Port of Rochester development next hour.